This is FSRN, the weekly edition. I'm Nell Abram. Coming up on this week's show, the U.S. government steps in and halts Dakota Access pipeline construction near Owyhee Lake, sacred to the Standing Rock Sioux. Retired miners struggle to retain health care coverage as coal companies declare bankruptcy. And prisoners across the United States mark the anniversary of the Attica uprising with a nationwide prison strike. Those stories and more on FSRN's Weekly Edition. Protests against the four-state Dakota Access Pipeline connecting the Bakken oil fields to infrastructure that runs to the Texas Gulf Coast continue to grow. A U.S. district judge was set to rule Friday on a highly anticipated injunction request seeking to halt work on the pipeline, but has delayed his decision until September 14th. The $3.7 billion, 1,200-mile-long pipeline would cross the Missouri River within a mile of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota. The tribe says the project endangers their water supply and the integrity of their sacred lands, and that they were not consulted as required under treaty law. The governor of North Dakota activated the National Guard Thursday, one day before the court ruling was due. Calling it an abundance of caution, Governor Jack Dalrymple told media he called in the Guard to supplement local law enforcement in the areas surrounding the protests.
Because of the increased and prolonged need for law enforcement resources, I have asked General Dorman to make available some North Dakota National Guard personnel to support law enforcement and augment their public safety efforts.
About 100 armed guardsmen will now staff roadside checkpoints in the vicinity of the Sacred Stone and Red Warrior camps. A long-planned powwow is set for this weekend in Bismarck, and officials expect an influx of Standing Rock supporters. Protests against the pipeline grew in early August when heavy machinery arrived and construction began. Thousands of people have now joined the Standing Rock Sioux, and members of more than 100 tribes have sent their flags in a show of indigenous solidarity. Protests have been largely peaceful until a private security firm brought attack dogs to the site last weekend. Governor Dalrymple dodged direct questions Wednesday about the use of trained canines by private contractors, but did say that the company behind the pipeline project has been asked not to escalate the situation unnecessarily. Tom Goldtooth is executive director of the Indigenous Environmental Network and is among the thousands of people staying put at what some say is now more of a village than a protest camp. Goldtooth notes that treaty rights give the Standing Rock Sioux tribe a government-to-government relationship with the United States.
We're not mere stakeholders. These are sovereign nations that have a relationship, a legal relationship with the United States government. And one of the foundations of that is a standard of consultation. Consultation was not recognized.
Goldtooth says the grassroots community is prepared to stay the course.
You know, I think talking to people here, we're here for the long run. We're here throughout winter if we have to. But there's people throughout the world who are looking and seeing what's going on here. But we're going to continue to build this resistance, build this solidarity, and mobilize people throughout the world to help us win this case.
Those who support the pipeline often cite job creation as one argument to shut down not just the Standing Rock Sioux, but environment-based opposition to fossil fuel and mining projects in general. Yet even those who spent decades working in the energy sector don't always benefit in the long run. In the recent wave of coal industry bankruptcies, companies are trying to renege on long-time contractual obligations to provide lifetime health benefits to retirees, even as they pay out multi-million dollar bonuses to CEOs. The United Mine Workers Union of America says a bill in Congress that would protect their members' health care coverage is critical to their well-being. FSRN's Melinda Tuhus reports from the coalfields of southern West Virginia.
Since 1947, retired members of the United Mine Workers Union have been entitled to lifetime medical benefits to deal with the health risks of a dirty, dangerous job, including black lung, which has seen a resurgence in recent years. Sitting in the Mine Workers Union office in Charleston, Retired miner Ron Pauley says their health benefits have always been top priority.
Well, in the beginning, doing all these contract negotiation stuff, we sort of put wages over the side because we figured we had health care, medical for a life, so we as well not to strike or nothing for as much for wages as we was to maintain our health care benefits. And now, with all these bankruptcies and the way the bankruptcy law is, we're in jeopardy of losing that.
In the past few years, more than 50 U.S. coal companies have declared bankruptcy as the price of fracked methane gas undercuts the thermal coal used by power plants and as Chinese demand has dropped for metallurgical coal used in steelmaking, which is the coal West Virginia produces. Even the biggest companies, Arch, Alpha Natural Resources, Patriot, and Peabody, have gone under, restructuring as smaller companies or selling off assets to new firms on the scene. Ron Pauley began mining in 1980 at a small family-oriented operation where he said the workers were treated well. It was bought out by Patriot, and he retired 2 years ago after 33 years in the mine. He said he went through bankruptcy twice with Patriot, in 2012 and 2015.
First time they got the bonuses, and I believe the first bonuses was, it was in the teens, millions of dollars. But then, same people managing same company filed bankruptcy again. Same people that got the bonus first time got 8.so many million again in bonuses. So they double-dipped twice on that, and judge give it to them, no questions asked.
In mid-August, top executives at Peabody, the world's biggest private sector coal company, were granted a total of $12 million in bonuses if they hit performance targets through the end of next year. Between 2013 and 2014, the number of coal workers and the price of coal nationally both dropped between 6 and 7%. The percentage of unionized miners has plummeted over the years. Now in southern West Virginia, the historic battleground for unionization, along with eastern Kentucky, non-union miners outnumber unionized workers in underground mines more than 6-1, and for surface mines, it's 10-1, according to federal data from the Energy Information Administration. There are only about 1,800 active unionized miners in District 17, which covers 36 counties in the southern part of West Virginia. Now the union is promoting the Miners Protection Act with companion bills in the U.S. House and Senate. The legislation would provide money from the Abandoned Mine Land Fund to cover the retired miners' health insurance. Joe Carter, vice president of District 17, says it's money that the coal companies pay for the reclamation of areas that have been mined, and there's about $3 billion currently in the fund.
We would basically be asking for use of some of the interest money from that fund. And it's not taxpayer dollars, it's money that the miners help the companies make.
The bill would also draw on money in the federal treasury, up to $490 million. If the interest from the Abandoned Mine Land Fund doesn't cover the entire need of retired miners whose companies have gone bankrupt, whatever money in that pot isn't used to cover health costs will go toward shoring up the miners' pension funds. In the next couple of years, 34,000 union retirees stand to lose their health benefits, Carter says. He adds that pensions are also at risk due to all the bankruptcies. The pension fund was about 90% funded as of 2008, but lost half its value in the Great Recession. All five members of West Virginia's congressional delegation are co-sponsors of the Miners Protection Act, and the total number of sponsors is 62 in the House and 18 in the Senate. One name that's missing is that of Kentucky Senator and Senate President Mitch McConnell, even though many eligible miners live in his state. Pauley says he and other miners have lobbied every Congress member and senator who would meet with them, but so far the bill, introduced last year, has failed to move forward. Some news reports have said it's an either-or choice between paying for retirees' health insurance or paying for environmental remediation of mine sites, a narrative pitting workers against the environment. But Carter says that both needs can be met. And Dustin White, a community organizer with the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition, agrees.
We feel that coal companies tend to treat their employees the same way they treat the environment, with little to no respect. And this is something that is definitely needed for the coal miners who have been left in this position by the industry.
Melinda Tuhus, FSRN, Charleston, West Virginia.
A recently enacted moratorium on public land leases for coal mining has industry interests claiming the government is waging a so-called war on coal. The White House says the moratorium is a chance to reevaluate the use of public land by an industry that heavily emits greenhouse gases, but so far hasn't held drilling companies to the same standard. Now, two nonprofits are suing the Obama administration regarding the climate and health effects associated with oil and gas drilling on nearly 400,000 acres of public land in Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming. Wild Earth Guardians and Physicians for Social Responsibility filed the lawsuit in late August in U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C. They say the drilling on public lands poses risks to both public health and the environment. The suit alleges that the White House is illegally refusing to research and publish the relevant information. Jeremy Nichols is Climate and Energy Program Director for Wild Earth Guardians.
There seems to be this understanding that our public lands are threatened by climate change, and yet we have the same administration basically bending over backwards to open up these same lands to the oil and gas industry. I think over the years, this awareness over the control that this administration has on the production end of fossil fuels has not really set in quite yet. There's been a lot of focus on smokestacks and tailpipes, and that is all good. But in the meantime, we are inadvertently incentivizing more and more fossil fuel consumption. I think it would surprise a lot of Americans to know that our public lands are being auctioned off for as little as $2 an acre to the oil and gas industry. We're basically subsidizing their profits, and we're the ones that are shouldering the climate costs at the end of the day. And so I think what we're trying to do is really drive home the point, and you know, a lawsuit is a very powerful vehicle for delivering that message.
In addition to the current hold on new coal leases on public lands, this lawsuit asks that the Obama administration extend that moratorium to all new oil and gas leases until a program-wide impact analysis is published, as required by the National Environmental Policy Act.
You're listening to FSRN, Free Speech, Radio News, independent, non-commercial media. To find out how you can support FSRN, visit our website, fsrn.org.
The U.S. Secretary of State and his Russian counterpart met in Geneva Friday, trying to work through the latest roadblocks to peace in Syria. The meeting comes on the heels of what has been widely reported as a chemical attack by Russian-supported Syrian regime forces targeting civilians in rebel-held eastern Aleppo. Robert Packard has more.
After months of relatively fruitless Syrian ceasefire talks brokered by the United Nations, the U.S. and Russian officials are at another diplomatic crossroads. Russia is reportedly stalling on the implementation of a ceasefire plan put forth weeks ago. Meanwhile, the humanitarian situation in the besieged city of Aleppo worsens. A video published Tuesday by frontline volunteer rescue workers known as the White Helmets shows doctors at an Aleppo hospital treating alleged victims of a chlorine gas attack. The chlorine was reportedly contained within three barrel bombs, a type of bomb favored by the regime of Bashar al-Assad. Multiple children appear in the video, breathing through oxygen masks. The Syrian American Medical Society, which operates healthcare facilities throughout Syria, says at least two people were killed and as many as 150 were injured in Tuesday's chlorine-laced bombing in the same area. The group says the gas attack was the 167th use of chemical weapons within Syria since the start of the civil war 5 years ago. For FSRN, I'm Robert Packard.
A case pitting tiny East Timor against Australia is now before the Hague's Permanent Court of Arbitration. At stake is jurisdiction over a disputed area of the Timor Sea and the oil riches beneath it. Georgia Clark reports from Sydney, Australia.
Under the center of the Timor Sea, between the northwest of Australia and Timor-Leste, rests an estimated $40 billion US dollars worth of oil and gas. The area known as Greater Sunrise is at the heart of a maritime boundary dispute between the two countries. Timor-Leste, otherwise known as East Timor, took Australia to international court in The Hague last week for a first-of-its-kind conciliation hearing. The Timorese argue that a 2006 treaty should be scrapped in light of revelations that Australia spied on Timorese cabinet rooms during negotiations. Rodney Lewis is a Sydney-based attorney and human rights advocate.
Timor-Leste wants a bigger share, but what they say is we are now a sovereign nation and we want sovereign maritime boundaries and borders.
In 2012, then Prime Minister of Timor-Leste, Xanana Gusmão, discovered that Australian intelligence eavesdropped on confidential conversations during negotiations for a treaty signed in 2006. President of the Australian Institute of International Affairs, Richard Broinowski, explains.
The offices of the cabinet in East Timor, in Dili, were bugged by ASIS, the Australian Security Intelligence Service, when under the guise of aid workers, they went in to construct the cabinet offices, and they bugged the walls. And this was actually done. So that was a black mark for Australia.
Australia argued in last week's court hearing that the tribunal does not have jurisdiction over the dispute, claiming that in the 2006 treaty, both parties agreed to a 50-50 split on profits from the reserves and to pause maritime boundary discussions for 50 years. In a statement to FSRN, a spokesperson for the Australian Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade wrote that Timor-Leste should abide by those treaty obligations. Abel Gutierrez is Timor-Leste's ambassador to Australia. He attended the compulsory conciliation hearings last week.
No, Timor-Leste arguing that it has a right to pursue its maritime border.
What bearing did Australia's bugging of the 2006 treaty agreements have on the decision of Timor-Leste to take Australia to arbitration?
Well, in a sense, Timor-Leste felt betrayed in a way that the negotiation for those temporary arrangements was not done in good faith. And so under the treaty laws, that becomes invalid.
The oil and gas deposits in the Greater Sunrise are minuscule in comparison to Australia's overall energy portfolio. But to tiny and impoverished Timor-Leste, where oil and gas revenues fund 90% of the national budget, these reserves are hugely important. The oil and gas in Greater Sunrise was discovered in 2002, the same year Timor-Leste became a sovereign nation after decades of Indonesian occupation and centuries of Portuguese colonisation. Australia brokered a deal a year later in which it claimed 80% of the largest part of the Greater Sunrise deposits. Broinowski says Australia took advantage of the new country with this disproportionate agreement.
Here's a desperately underdeveloped country of 900,000 people, a million people, very small, and the president and the cabinet want that money to develop the infrastructure of their country. That's not greed, that's perfectly acceptable and perfectly understandable. The other thing to say is that Australia is an immensely rich country, point one. Why would we want 80 or 90% of this offtake? That is greed on Australia's part, in my view.
The Australian government argues it was only seeking to quickly clarify a long-standing maritime boundary issue. The disputed area was called the Timor Gap in a 1989 treaty with Indonesia, the then occupying power in East Timor. Sister Susan Connolly is with the Timor Sea Forum, an organisation that supports East Timor's campaign to determine its boundaries with Australia.
Timor's case is that it has been asking Australia for the last 14 years to sit down and to discuss the setting of an internationally recognised maritime boundary in the Timor Sea. Unfortunately, Australia has not come to the party and has been satisfied to commandeer Timor into signing various temporary resource agreements.
The Court of Arbitration will decide on the matter within the year. Then, if the tribunal orders the two countries to negotiate a permanent maritime boundary, Broinowski says that the sites of both parties will remain fixed on the Greater Sunrise. Georgia Clark, FSRN, Sydney, Australia.
Zimbabwe's High Court declared a recent ban on protests is unconstitutional this week. overturning a Mugabe-led move to stifle dissent in the country. FSRN's Gerikai Chaunza has more from Harare.
Opposition parties and human rights activists are hailing the decision by High Court Justice Priscilla Chigumba. The ruling comes on the heels of a lightly veiled threat from President Robert Mugabe, who said Saturday that judges, quote, dare not be negligent in their decisions, close quote, on legal challenges to a two-week ban on public protests in the country. Amid widespread revolt, late last week the government invoked the prohibition on protest. The move came after a coalition of political parties called the National Electoral Reform Agenda, or NERA, reapplied for a permit to demonstrate in central Harare last Friday. Until a few years ago, public protest in the country was rare because the nation's constitution included strict rules for public gatherings and demonstrations. But those rules were tossed out when voters approved a new constitution in 2013. Tendai Biti, the attorney representing NERA, told reporters outside the court that the judgment shows the independence of the judiciary.
The court spelled out the fundamental issues as defined in the constitution, namely that we are in a constitutional democracy and that the courts are independent and they operate without fear and favor. And in that breath, the court proceeded to hand down a very brief judgment in favor of liberty, in favor of the freedoms that are enshrined in the constitution.
Since May, Zimbabwe has seen a series of escalating protests with people expressing anger at President Robert Mugabe. They say he is ruining the country that's now crippled by a cash crunch and labor crisis. Mugabe has reacted by unleashing armed police details to beat up and arrest peaceful protesters. In recent weeks, hundreds of thousands of dollars of property has been damaged as civilians fight back against the repression. Justice Chigumba stayed her order for 7 days to allow the government a chance to appeal. Gerikai Chaunza, FSRN, Harare.
FSRN is independent media supported by listeners like you. For more information about how to keep us on the air and online, please visit our website at fsrn.org.
Funeral services are set for Saturday for Livonia Riggins, an unarmed African-American man killed last week by a law enforcement officer in Tampa, Florida. Protesters have remained in the streets for more than a week. Local activist Michelle Williams.
We will not be quiet while they continue to kill us in the streets. We will not let anyone tell us to be quiet while they cover up this great injustice.
A Hillsborough County Sheriff's deputy serving a search warrant shot and killed 22-year-old Livonia Riggins at his home the morning of August 30th. Colonel Donna Luzinski is chief investigator of the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Department's internal probe. At a press conference, she said the warrant was a culmination of a months-long undercover investigation involving marijuana sales and that the police had reason to believe there might be guns in the house. A SWAT team arrived at the home at about 8 a.m. and ordered the occupants to vacate the premises. Three people exited. Mr. Riggins remained inside. According to the police version of events, Officer Caleb Johnson broke a window and observed Riggins still in bed.
Again, Mr. Riggins did not comply and was moving under the covers. Repeated commands were again given, and Deputy Johnson's concern grew.
Colonel Luzinski said Riggins got out of bed, and the deputy feared he was getting a weapon.
Mr. Riggins then jumped up and moved his hands towards his waistband, at which time Deputy Johnson fired his firearm one time, just one time.
Medics at the scene were unable to revive him. 2 grams of marijuana was found at the home. No guns were recovered. In Florida, possession of 20 grams or less can be prosecuted as misdemeanor possession. A ballot initiative to legalize marijuana for medical purposes is up for a vote in November. Hillsborough County Sheriff David Gee has pledged transparency, but no additional information has been released since Monday. The Sheriff's Department investigation is ongoing. and Officer Johnson is on paid administrative leave. Prisoners across the United States are marking the September 9th anniversary of the Attica uprising with what could be the largest and most widespread prison strike in history. Supporters on the outside are holding solidarity actions to make the strike visible to the world beyond prison walls. Samuel Bowman reports from Portland.
About 50 people packed into a muggy back room of Portland's Anaris Info Shop for a live concert as part of a series of nationwide events aimed at organizing outside support for the striking prisoners.
Slavery was never ended in the United States, right? 13th Amendment, check it out, you know, it says that slavery shall be abolished for everything except for as used for a punishment of a crime.
That's Tyler with the Portland Anarchist Black Cross, a group that produces and distributes a zine written by and for prisoners.
People are working for literally no money or pennies on the dollar. So it's making a lot of money for corporations such as McDonald's, Starbucks, Victoria's Secrets, JCPenney's. All these corporations use prison labor and make a killing off of it.
The strikers' demands vary from prison to prison, but a central focus is exploitative prison labor. The September 9th strike coincides with the 45th anniversary of the Attica prison uprising in upstate New York. It's part of what many prisoners and activists are calling a new movement for prisoners' rights, says Asura Crispino of the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, or IWOC. That group has been helping to organize the strike by bridging gaps in direct communication between prisoners.
Most of the work has been done by outside organizers, in terms of taking information that began with the prisoners, for example, the zine, but the crop rot in the field, but then mailing it out to other prisoners. So there's definitely been a conduit of outside organizers getting the information to folks to say, hey, the date that we're all mobilizing on is September 9th.
Crispino expects some retaliation from corrections staff based on the reaction to previous prison strikes and actions in states like Texas and California.
We had several reports of units where pretty brutal repression occurred. There was at least one unit in which water and power was turned off from 6 a.m. to midnight, and then the prisoners were gassed.
Crispino says that increased public awareness this time around will make it harder for corrections agencies to deny the strike or put it down with violence. For its part, the Oregon Department of Corrections responded to an interview request with an emailed statement saying officers were aware of plans for a strike but had, quote, not received any information specific to action in Oregon. One thing is for sure, though. However many prisoners strike in Oregon, their supporters will be on the streets Friday afternoon to make sure the public knows about it. Sam Bowman, FSRN, Portland.
And that does it for this week's program. FSRN is supported by stations that air our show and by listeners like you. Visit our website to hear extended audio versions and read transcripts of stories heard on today's program. Shannon Young provides editorial services from Oaxaca, Mexico. Robert Packard provides technical support from WTJU in Charlottesville, Virginia. Music in today's show is by Zixidi via Jamendo.com. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram. Thanks for listening.